Audio Literature presents A Separate Reality by Carlos Castaneda, read by Peter Coyote.
Years ago, I had the fortune of meeting a Yaqui Indian from northwestern Mexico. I call him Don Juan. In Spanish, Don is an appellative used to denote respect. I made Don Juan's acquaintance under the most fortuitous circumstances. I was sitting with Bill, a friend of mine, in a bus depot in a border town in Arizona. We were very quiet. In the late afternoon, the summer heat seemed unbearable. Suddenly, he leaned over and tapped me on the shoulder. "There's the man I told you about," he said in a low voice. He nodded casually toward the entrance. An old man had just walked in. "What did you tell me about him?" I asked. "He's the Indian that knows about peyote, remember?" Don Juan and I became friends, and for a year I paid him innumerable visits. I found his manner very reassuring and his sense of humor superb. But above all, I felt there was a silent consistency about his acts, a consistency which was thoroughly baffling to me. I felt a strange delight in his presence, and at the same time I experienced a strange discomfort. His mere company forced me to make a tremendous reevaluation of my models of behavior. I had been reared, perhaps like everyone else, to have a readiness to accept man as an essentially weak and fallible creature. What impressed me about Don Juan was the fact that he did not make a point of being weak and helpless, and just being around him ensured an unfavorable comparison between his way of behaving and mine. In 1961, a year after our first meeting, Don Juan disclosed to me that he had a secret knowledge of medicinal plants. He told me he was a brujo. The Spanish word brujo can be rendered in English as sorcerer, medicine man, curer. From that point on, the relation between us changed. I became his apprentice, and for the next 4 years, he endeavored to teach me the mysteries of sorcery. I have written about that apprenticeship in the teachings of Don Juan, A Yaqui Way of Knowledge. Don Juan's method of teaching required an extraordinary effort on the part of the apprentice. In fact, the degree of participation and involvement needed was so strenuous that by the end of 1965, I had to withdraw from the apprenticeship. I can say now, with the perspective of the 5 years that have elapsed, that at that time, Don Juan's teachings had begun to pose a serious threat to my idea of the world. I had begun to lose the certainty which all of us have that the reality of everyday life is something we can take for granted. At the time of my withdrawal, I was convinced that my decision was final. I did not want to see Don Juan ever again. However, in April of 1968, an early copy of my book was made available to me, and I felt compelled to show it to him. I paid him a visit. April 2nd, 1968. Don Juan looked at me for a moment and did not seem at all surprised to see me, even though it had been more than 2 years since I last visited him. He put his hand on my shoulder and smiled gently and said that I looked different, that I was getting fat and soft. I had brought him a copy of my book. Without any preliminaries, I took it out of my briefcase and handed it to him. "It's a book about you, Don Juan," I said. He took it and flipped through the pages as if they were a deck of cards. He liked the green color on the dust jacket and the height of the book. He felt the cover with his palms, turned it around a couple of times, and then handed it back to me. I felt a great surge of pride. "I want you to keep it," I said. He shook his head with a silent laugh. "I better not," he said, and then added with a broad smile, "You know what we do with paper in Mexico." I laughed. I thought his touch of irony was beautiful. My visit to Don Juan started a new cycle. I had no trouble falling back again into my old pattern of enjoying his sense of drama and his humor and his patience with me. I definitely felt that I had to visit him more often. Not to see Don Juan was indeed a great loss for me. May 21st, 1968. Nothing out of the ordinary happened during my trip to see Don Juan. The temperature in the desert was over 100 degrees and was quite uncomfortable. The heat subsided in the late afternoon, and by the time I arrived at his house in the early evening, there was a cool breeze. I was not very tired, so we sat in his room and talked. I felt comfortable and relaxed, and we talked for hours. We were talking about Oaxaca. I told Don Juan that once I had arrived in the city on a day when market was open, A day when scores of Indians from all over the area flocked to town to sell food and all kinds of trinkets. I mentioned that I was particularly interested in a man who was selling medicinal plants. He carried a wooden kit in which he kept a number of small jars with dry, shredded plants, and he stood in the middle of the street holding one jar, yelling a very peculiar sing-song. "I bring here," he would say, "for fleas, flies, mosquitoes, and lice. Also for pigs, horses, goats, and cows. I have here for all the maladies of man, the mumps, the measles, rheumatism, and gout. I bring here for the heart, the liver, the stomach, and the loin. Come near, ladies and gentlemen. I bring here for fleas, flies, mosquitoes, and lice." I had listened to him for a long time. His format consisted of enumerating a long list of man's diseases for which he claimed to have a cure. The device he used to give rhythm to his sing-song was to pause after naming a set of four. Don Juan said that he also used to sell herbs in the market in Oaxaca when he was young. He said he still remembered his selling pitch, and he yelled it for me. He said that he and his friend Vicente used to make concoctions. "Those concoctions were really good," Don Juan said. "My friend Vicente used to make great extracts of plants." I told Don Juan that once during one of my trips to Mexico, I had met his friend Vicente. Don Juan seemed to be surprised and wanted to know more about it. I was driving through Durango at that time and remembered that Don Juan had once told me I should pay a visit to his friend who lived there. I looked for him and found him and talked to him for a while. Before I left, he gave me a sack with some plants and a series of instructions for replanting one of them. I stopped on my way to the town of Aguas Calientes. I made sure that there were no people around. For at least 10 minutes I had been watching the road and surrounding areas. There had not been any houses in sight, nor cattle grazing alongside the road. I stopped on the top of a small hill. From there I could see the road ahead and behind me. It was deserted in both directions as far into the distance as I could see. I waited for a few minutes to orient myself and to remember Don Vicente's instructions. I took one of the plants, walked into a field of cacti on the east side of the road, and planted it as Don Vicente had instructed me. I had with me a bottle of mineral water with which I intended to sprinkle the plant. I tried to open it by hitting the cap with a small iron bar I had used as a digging stick, but the bottle exploded and a glass sliver nicked my upper lip and made it bleed. I walked back to my car to get another bottle of mineral water. As I was getting it out of my trunk, a man driving a VW station wagon stopped and asked me if I needed help. I said that everything was all right, and he drove away. I returned to water the plant, and then I started back toward my car. When I was perhaps 100 feet away, I heard some voices. I hurried down a slope onto the highway and found 3 Mexicans at the car, 2 men and 1 woman. One of the men was sitting on the front bumper. He was perhaps in his late 30s, of medium height with black curly hair. He was carrying a bundle on his back and was wearing old slacks and a worn-out pinkish shirt. His shoes were untied and perhaps too big for his feet. They seemed to be loose and uncomfortable. He was sweating profusely. The other man was standing about 20 feet away from the car. He was small-boned and shorter than the other man, and his hair was straight and combed backwards. He carried a smaller bundle and was older, perhaps in his late 40s. His clothes were in better condition. He had on a dark blue jacket, light blue slacks, and black shoes. He was not perspiring at all and seemed aloof, uninterested. The woman appeared to be also in her 40s. She was fat and had a very dark complexion. She wore black capris, a white sweater, and black pointed shoes. She did not carry a bundle, but was holding a portable transistor radio. She seemed to be very tired, and her face was covered with beads of perspiration. When I approached them, the younger man and the woman accosted me. They wanted a ride. I told them I did not have any space in my car. I showed them that the back seat was loaded to capacity and there was really no room left. The man suggested that if I drove slow, they could go perched on the back bumper or lying across the front fender. I thought the idea was preposterous, yet there was such an urgency in their plea that I felt very sad and ill at ease. I gave them some money for their bus fare. The younger man took the bills and thanked me, but the older man turned his back disdainfully. "I want transportation," he said. "I'm not interested in money." Then he turned to me. "Can't you give us some food or water?" he asked. I really had nothing to give them. They stood there looking at me for a moment, and then they began to walk away. I got into my car and tried to start the motor. The heat was very intense, and the motor seemed to be flooded. The younger man stopped when he heard the starter grinding and came back and stood behind my car ready to push it. I felt a tremendous apprehension. I was actually panting desperately. The motor finally ignited and I zoomed away. After I'd finished relating this, Don Juan remained pensive for a long time. "Why haven't you told me this before?" he said without looking at me. I didn't know what to say. I shrugged my shoulders and told him that I never thought it was important. "It's damn important," he said. "Vicente is a first-rate sorcerer. He gave you something to plant because he had his reasons. And if you encountered three people who seemed to have popped out of nowhere right after you had planted it, there was a reason for that too. But only a fool like you would disregard the incident and think it wasn't important." Don Juan shook his head from side to side and in a half-kidding tone expressed his bewilderment at what he called my baffling good luck. He said that my visiting Don Vicente was like walking into a lion's den armed with a twig. "You're a damn fool," he said, and looked stern for a moment. "But I followed Don Vicente's instructions to the letter." "So what? Don't you understand that to follow his instructions was meaningless?" "Why?" "Because those instructions were designed for someone who could see, not for an idiot who got out with his life just by sheer luck. You went to see Vicente without preparation. He liked you and gave you a gift, and that gift could easily have cost you your life." "But why did he give me something so serious? If he's a sorcerer, he should have known that I don't know anything." "No, he couldn't have seen that. You look as though you know, but you don't know much, really." I said I was sincerely convinced that I had never misrepresented myself, or at least not deliberately. He was quiet for some time, then he shrugged his shoulders and smiled. "It's useless to complain," he said, "and yet it's so difficult not to. Gifts of power happen so rarely in one's life. They're unique and precious. Take me, for instance. Nobody has ever made me such a gift. There are few people, to my knowledge, who ever had one. To waste something so unique is a shame." "I see what you mean, Don Juan," I said. "Is there anything I can do now to salvage the gift?" He laughed and repeated several times, "To salvage the gift." "That sounds nice," he said. "I like that. Yet there isn't anything one can do to salvage your gift." May 25th, 1968. Don Juan spent nearly all his time today showing me how to assemble trapping devices for small animals. We had been cutting and cleaning branches nearly all morning. There were many questions in my mind. I had to talk to him while we worked, but he had made a joke and said that of the two of us, only I could move my hands and my mouth at the same time. We finally sat down to rest, and I blurted out a question. "Don't I see things as they really are?" "No. Your eyes have learned only to look. Take, for example, the three people you encountered, the three Mexicans. You've described them in detail and even told me what clothes they wore, and that only proved to me that you didn't see them at all. If you were capable of seeing, you would have known on the spot that they were not people." "They were not people. What were they?" "They were not people, that's all." "But that's impossible. They were just like you and me." "No, they were not. I'm sure of it." Don Juan said that the three people I had seen, whom he called those who are not people, los que no son gente, were in reality Don Vicente's allies. Real people look like luminous eggs when you see them. Non-people always look like people. That's what I meant when I said you cannot see an ally. "Do you mean that some of the people I see in the streets are not really people?" I asked, truly bewildered by his statement. "Some of them are not," he said emphatically. On September 4th, 1968, I went to Sonora to visit Don Juan. Following a request he had made during my previous visit to him, I stopped on the way in Hermosillo to buy him a non-commercial tequila called Bocanora. His request seemed very odd to me at that time since I knew he disliked drinking, but I bought four bottles and put them in a box along with other things I had brought for him. "Why, you got four bottles," he said, laughing when he opened the box. "I asked you to buy me one. I believe you thought the Bocanora was for me, but it's for my grandson, Lucio, and you have to give it to him as though it's a personal gift of your own." I had met Don Juan's grandson 2 years before. He was 28 years old then. He was very tall, over 6 feet, and was always extravagantly well-dressed for his means and in comparison to his peers. Lucio was delighted to receive the liquor and immediately took the bottles inside his house, apparently to put them away. Don Juan made a casual comment that one should never hoard liquor and drink alone. Lucio's house was a flimsy, two-room, dirt-floor, waddle-and-daub construction. There were 8 men inside the house, including Don Juan. Lucio addressed the whole group in Spanish and said in a loud voice that we were going to drink one bottle of Bacanora that I had brought for him from Hermosillo. He went into the other room, brought out a bottle, uncorked it, and gave it to me along with a small tin cup. I poured a very small amount into the cup and drank it. The Bacanora seemed to be more fragrant and more dense than regular tequila, and stronger, too. It made me cough. I passed the bottle, and everyone poured himself a small drink, everyone except Don Juan. He just took the bottle and placed it in front of Lucio, who was at the end of the line. All of them made lively comments about the rich flavor of that particular bottle, and all of them agreed that the liquor must have come from the high mountains of Chihuahua. The bottle went around a second time. The men smacked their lips, repeated their statements of praise. During the second time around, Don Juan again did not drink, and I poured only a dab for myself, but the rest of them filled the cup to the brim. The bottle went around once more and was finished. "Get the other bottles, Lucio," Don Juan said. Lucio seemed to vacillate, and Don Juan quite casually explained to the others that I had brought four bottles for Lucio. "Carlos is learning about mezcalito, and I'm teaching him," Don Juan said. All of them looked at me and smiled politely. Lucio went into the other room and returned with another bottle of Bacanora. He opened it, poured himself a large drink, and then passed it around. The conversation drifted to the probabilities of an American company coming to Sonora and its possible effect on the Yaquis. At one moment, the topics of conversation seemed to wane away. Don Juan turned to me and said loudly, "Why don't you tell the guys here about your encounters with mezcalito?" "Is mezcalito peyote, Grandpa?" Lucio asked curiously. "Some people call it that way," Don Juan said dryly. "I prefer to call it mezcalito." "That confounded thing causes madness," said Gennaro, a tall, husky, middle-aged man. "I think it's stupid to say that mezcalito causes madness," Don Juan said softly. "Because if that were the case, Carlos would be in a straitjacket this very moment instead of being here talking to you. He has taken it, and look at him. He's fine." Bahia smiled and replied shyly, "Who can tell?" And everybody laughed. "Look at me then," Don Juan said. "I've known mezcalito nearly all my life, and it has never hurt me." The men did not laugh, but it was obvious that they were not taking him seriously. "On the other hand," Don Juan went on, "it's true that mezcalito drives people crazy, as you said, but that's only when they come to him without knowing what they're doing." Esquerre, an old man who seemed to be Don Juan's age, chuckled softly as he shook his head from side to side. "What do you mean by knowing, Juan?" he asked. "The last time I saw you, you were saying the same thing." "People really go crazy when they take that peyote stuff," Gennaro continued. "I've seen the Huichol Indians eating it. They acted as if they had rabies." "Don Juan says there is a spirit in peyote," Benigno said. "I've seen peyote in the field, but I've never seen spirits or anything of that sort," Bahia added. "Mezcalito is like a spirit, perhaps," Don Juan explained. "But whatever he is doesn't become clear until one knows about him. Bahia says that whoever takes it becomes an animal. Well, I don't see it that way. To me, those who think they are above animals live worse than animals. Look at my grandson here. He works without rest. I would say he lives to work like a mule. And all he does that is not animal-like is to get drunk." Everybody laughed. Victor, a very young man who seemed to be still in adolescence, laughed in a pitch above everybody else. Eligio, a young farmer, had not uttered a single word so far. He was sitting on the floor to my right. "In what way would peyote change all this?" he asked. "It seems to me that a man is born to work all his life, like mules do." "Mezcalito changes everything," Don Juan said. "Yet we still have to work like everybody else, like mules." "How can it change us?" Eligio insisted. "He teaches us the right way to live," Don Juan said. "He helps and protects those who know him. The life you fellows are leading is no life at all. You don't know the happiness that comes from doing things deliberately. You don't have a protector. This is why you fellows are all drunkards. Look at my grandson here."
"Cut it out, Grandpa," Lucio protested.
"He's not lazy or stupid," Don Juan went on. "But what else does he do besides drink?"
"He buys leather jackets," Gennaro remarked, and the whole audience roared. Lucio gulped down more Bacanora. "And how is peyote going to change that?" Eligio asked.
"If Lucio would seek the protector," Don Juan said, "his life would be changed. I don't know exactly how, but I'm sure it would be different."
"He would stop drinking? Is that what you mean?" Eligio insisted. Perhaps he would. He needs something else beside tequila to make his life satisfying. If you think how little we know and how much there is to see, booze is what makes people crazy. It blurs the images. Mezcalito, on the other hand, sharpens everything. It makes you see so very well, so very well. Lucio and Benigno looked at each other and smiled as though they had already heard the story before. Gennaro and Esquerre grew more impatient and began to talk at the same time. Victor laughed above all the other voices. The only one interested seemed to be Eligio. "How can Peyote do all that?" he asked. "In the first place," Don Juan explained, "you must want to become acquainted with him, and I think this is by far the most important thing. Then you must be offered to him, and you must meet with him many times before you can say you know him." "And what happens then?" Eligio asked. Gennaro interrupted. "You crap on the roof with your ass on the ground." The audience roared. There was a long pause. The men seemed to be tired. The bottle was empty. Lucio, with obvious reluctance, opened another. "Is Peyote Carlos' protector too?" Eligio asked. "I wouldn't know that," Don Juan said. "He's taken it 3 times, so ask him to tell you about it." They all turned to me curiously, and Eligio asked, "Did you really take it?" "Yes, I did." "Didn't it hurt your mouth?" Lucio asked. "It did. It also tasted terrible." "Were you afraid?" Benigno asked. "I certainly was." "Why did you do it then?" Eligio asked. "He said he wanted to know," Lucio answered for me. "I think Carlos is getting to be like my grandpa. Both have been saying they want to know, but nobody knows what in the hell they want to know." "It is impossible to explain that knowing," Don Juan said to Eligio, "because it is different for every man." Eligio seemed to be nervous. He said to Don Juan, "How can Peyote change our life? How?" Don Juan did not answer. He stared fixedly at Eligio for a moment and then began to sing in Yaqui. It was not a song proper, but a short recitation. We remained quiet for a long time. Then I asked Don Juan to translate the Yaqui words for me. "That was only for Yaquis," he said matter-of-factly. I felt dejected. I was sure he had said something of great importance. Don Juan got up. "It's time to go home," he said. "Lucio is drunk and Victor is asleep." September 16th, 1968. Don Juan and I sat quietly for a very long time. He seemed to be tired. I broke the silence and asked him about Eligio. Don Juan did not speak for a long time. He seemed to have become engulfed by thoughts. "My setup was for Lucio," he said, "and I found Eligio instead. I knew it was useless, but when we like someone, we should properly insist, as though it were possible to remake men. Lucio had courage when he was a little boy, and then he lost it along the way." He said that Lucio had always been his great concern, and that at one time they had lived together and were very close. But Lucio became gravely ill when he was 7, and Don Juan's son, a devout Catholic, made a vow to the Virgin of Guadalupe that Lucio would join a sacred dancing society if his life were spared. Lucio recovered and was forced to carry out the promise. He lasted 1 week as an apprentice and then made up his mind to break the vow. He thought he would have to die as a result of it, braced himself, and for a whole day he waited for death to come. Everybody made fun of the boy, and the incident was never forgotten. October 4th, 1968. At a certain moment today, I asked Don Juan if he minded talking a bit more about seeing. "If you want to see, you have to let the smoke guide you," he said emphatically. "I won't talk about this anymore." I was helping him clean some dry herbs. We worked in complete silence for a long time. At a given moment, I brought up a question to him in a sort of compulsive, almost belligerent outburst. "How does a man of knowledge exercise controlled folly when it comes to the death of a person he loves?" I asked. Don Juan was taken aback by my question and looked at me quizzically. "Take your grandson, Lucio," I said. "Would your acts be controlled folly at the time of his death?" "Take my son, Eulalio. That's a better example," Don Juan replied calmly. "He was crushed by rocks while working in the construction of the Pan-American Highway. My acts toward him at the moment of his death were controlled folly. When I came down to the blasting area, he was almost dead, but his body was so strong that it kept on moving and kicking. I stood in front of him and told the boys in the road crew not to move him anymore. They obeyed me and stood there surrounding my son, looking at his mangled body. I stood there too, but I did not look. I shifted my eyes so I would see his personal life disintegrating, expanding uncontrollably beyond its limits, like a fog of crystals, because that is the way life and death mix and expand. That is what I did at the time of my son's death. That's all one could ever do, and that is controlled folly. Had I looked at him, I would have watched him becoming immobile, and I would have felt a cry inside of me because never again would I look at his fine figure pacing the earth. I saw his death instead, and there was no sadness, no feeling. His death was equal to everything else. Don Juan was quiet for a moment. He seemed to be sad, but then he smiled and tapped my head. I thought about the people I love myself, and a terribly oppressive wave of self-pity enveloped me. Lucky you, Don Juan, I said. You can shift your eyes while I can only look. He found my statement funny and laughed. Lucky? Bull, he said. It's hard work.